Welcome to the Heal, Nourish, Grow podcast. I'm Cheryl McColgan, founder of Heal, Nourish, Grow. The website, this show, and our newsletter all focus on making the science of advanced nutrition and greater overall health accessible to everyone. Buckle up for our latest episode to get ideas, tools, and practical knowledge you can use to improve your health and move towards your perfect version of ultimate wellness. The Heal, Nourish, Grow podcast shares interviews with nutrition experts, health researchers, and everyday people that have changed their lifestyle and nutrition to support greater health. You'll learn how to implement lasting change and create new habits that support greater wellness and a happier, healthier life. Please visit healnourishgrowpodcast.com for full show notes and links to our guests.
Susan Salinger is the author and researcher behind Sidelined: How Women Can Navigate a Broken Healthcare System. Sidelined examines the many ways in which some women manage and sometimes mismanage their healthcare. Susan explores how women, typically the medical gatekeepers for their families, tend to be extremely conscientious about taking care of themselves, yet at the same time inadvertently undermine their own care. They often hesitate to call the doctor when they don't feel well and worry that their doctor visit will take time away from their families or work. They may hesitate to ask doctors the necessary questions and don't always comply with doctors' instructions. Salinger's research reveals how conflicted many women are about the medical decisions they ultimately make. Born and raised in Los Angeles, Susan attended UCLA to study English. After graduation, she worked with her husband Fred for 25 years at the production company Salinger Films, which produced corporate training and development videos distributed worldwide. Today, at age 81, Susan lives in Northern California to be near her incredible family, which includes her two daughters, four grandchildren, a cat named Max, a dog named JD, in parentheses, Salinger. And when she's not speaking about her book or spending time with family and friends, you will find Susan powerlifting to stay in shape. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Heal, Nourish, Grow podcast. Today, I have with me Susan Salinger, which I had to kind of, you'll notice when I read her intro, I had a little giggle because her dog is actually named J.D. Salinger after the famous American author. So I got a big kick out of that. But anyway, Susan is joining us today to talk about her book. It's called Sidelined, and it's all about how women can, first of all, the issues with navigating our current healthcare system and how women can learn a few things that can help them better navigate it for their families, for their own healthcare. And I don't want to say too much about that because Susan's going to tell us all about it. But before we get into that, Susan, I read your official bio, but I would love if you could share with people your little bit of backstory about your health, how you got into this, you know, wanting to do this research with women. And because it's in your bio, 81 years old, I mean, that's amazing. Yes. That you did this work at a later time in life. So I'm just really curious to hear, like, what lit your fire to want to interview people and write this book?
Well, you know, it was a long journey and it was serendipitous to a certain extent. Many years ago, I mean, when I was like in my 20s or 30s, I agreed to have some exploratory surgery that I was positive I didn't need. I was on hormones. I think it was for osteoporosis, even that young. I can't remember anymore. And I was doing fine. And the doctor said, well, hey, you know, there's this new medication. It's even better. Let's try it. And I'm sure, you know, what the hell? So I tried it. And then I started some vaginal bleeding and had symptoms. And so I said, I better go back to the other medication. This isn't agreeing with me. And he said, no, 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 no. I'm sure it's not the medication. I've never had anybody say that before. And he did a bunch of tests and everything was normal. And he said, we really need to do exploratory surgery. He was really worried about it. I know he was looking for ovarian cancer. And if he'd been right, I mean, he would have saved my life. But he wasn't right. And we did the surgery. I was just, I knew I shouldn't have done it. But anyway, I was fine. Okay, end of story. Life goes on. And then many years later, after my husband and I sold our business, I mean, you know, 30 years went by, but I retired and that lasted maybe 2 or 3 seconds. I'm the wrong woman to retire. It didn't work. So I went back to school. I mean, I've told you it was a long story, but all I could get into was anthropology. Everything else was closed. So I took some classes and I thought it would be really fun, which it was. I loved it. And for one of the classes, I did a project on women who had hysterectomies. Why hysterectomies? I've never had one. I don't know, but that's what it was. And a couple of them had actually agreed to the hysterectomy surgery, even though they didn't think they needed it. In fact, they said that they were sure their symptoms were just premenopausal. So, but nevertheless, they too agreed to the surgery. And that really triggered my memory. And I thought, oh my gosh, as women, how do we make our medical decisions? Why do we do this to ourselves? I mean, in my own case, I could have investigated. I mean, I could have gotten a second opinion. I didn't. I could have done some research. I didn't. I could have waited a week or two and gone back on the old pills just to see what happens. I didn't. I mean, I just did it. And that's what these other women had told me about their hysterectomies. So that's really how I got into the book. I started doing some research, and I actually, what I did is I interviewed about, I think, I don't know, 50, 60 women and discovered what they had in common, all with different diseases, but I was interested in their behavior. And, you know, did they get second opinions? What happened at their doctor visit? That kind of thing. And I found, you know, several things we all have in common, and there it is.
Wow. I don't know. So I'm guessing that your publicist, maybe she did or didn't read my bio. I would be curious now to know that, having heard your backstory, because I had a hysterectomy at age 32.
Oh my goodness.
And yes. And unfortunately, I had a lot of pain, and it was a little bit slightly more clear cut, not totally clear cut, but what you're saying right now is totally taking me back to that place and the decisions I made at the time and how it really seemed to be the right thing. And yet in retrospect, and that's often the case, right? We can't always know until it's down the road.
It's, you know, it's a wonderful thing, but it can be so destructive.
Yes, for sure. I mean, you can't second guess yourself a million times, yet you can. So I'm really happy that you're providing this as a resource, because at some point, maybe a future podcast, maybe I'll go into all my decision-making process, because there's a lot of nuggets, I think, to be had there. And I think certainly the second opinion is probably one of the most important.
You know, it really is. It's probably, well, maybe the second most important chapter in the book, because as women, men do too, but women really hesitate to get second opinions. We don't want to be rude, and we don't want to hurt the doctor's feelings, and. I mean, we have 100 reasons not. It's also a pain in the neck. I mean, let's face it. And you're not feeling well, you know. So now I'm saying, I know you don't feel good. I know it's a pain in the neck, but get in your car and go do it anyway. But that is what I'm saying. And I'll tell you what I learned, which I did not know until I did the research for this book, is that there's about 30, 40, maybe even 50,000 diseases out there. And those are the ones we know about. I mean, COVID's probably, you know, 40,001, because there are a lot of diseases we don't yet know about. But, you know, for a doctor, a diagnosis is pretty much like looking in a haystack, for a needle in a haystack. So many of these diseases, their symptoms mimic each other. I mean, if you have pain in your leg and you get your leg x-rayed and it's broken, that's a no-brainer. But if you go in and say, I'm tired and I have no energy and I'm irritable and I have no appetite, I mean, those symptoms, they can fit 29,000 of the 30. Yeah, it's a really difficult thing. And the other thing I learned, and this is all why we should get second opinions, is as people, as doctors, we all see what we expect to see. So the same symptoms will be stomach problems to a gastroenterologist, stress to a psychologist, joint issues to a rheumatologist. And they may be right or wrong. I mean, it's just we see what we expect to see, and you tend to diagnose what you see most often. So, I mean, a second opinion is really a very important thing to get when it's something serious, like a hysterectomy or like the exploratory surgery I had.
Yeah, absolutely. And so you were doing the anthropology courses, and it sounds like in the process of that, you heard from some people that brought these feelings up again. Did you use those people in your research? I think you said you interviewed like 60 people. So where did you find, once this ball got rolling, how did you find the other women to talk to?
You know, it turned out to be fairly easy, actually. I went to support groups. And once I got through I emailed the people that were leading the group. And once I got into the first one or two, it snowballed. I mean, Jane knew Joan and Joan knew Janet and. So that's really how it developed. And since I did it by disease, because I had interviewed women who had endometriosis, so I went to that support group. Fibromyalgia, I went to that support group, et cetera. And then I decided I needed the women I interviewed were mostly near local for me in California. And so then I decided I needed more geographical diversity. So I put together some focus groups and got women just over Zoom from all over the country. And that was really helpful. Wow. So it wasn't as difficult as you would think, actually.
If you've been around my content for a while, you know that one of my favorite things is making and eating gourmet food and pairing it with wine. You might think you can't enjoy wine, though, while trying to lose weight or stay in ketosis. And if you're drinking traditional wine, you might be right. So many wines are mass-produced and full of sugar and other garbage additives that can wreak havoc on your health goals and just make you feel bad. Fortunately, I discovered Dry Farm Wines. I've been drinking their wine for years now, and I love this company. They individually test small batch wines produced by vintners that are committed to the practice of dry farm production. Some of my favorites have been the Blaufränkisch variety from Austria and all of the wines from the Loire Valley in France. Dry Farm wines are free from excess sulfites and mold that can cause adverse reactions and hangovers. With no added sugar, each wine is tested to be under 1 gram of sugar in the entire bottle. Yep, you just heard that right. There's less than one carb in the whole bottle of wine. They're also slightly lower alcohol, which means you can enjoy a delicious wine pairing at dinner any given night and not end up with a hangover. You can receive an extra bottle for just a penny with your first order by visiting dryfarmwines.com/healnourishgrow. I'd love to hear what your favorite wine is after you try it, and be sure to tag me on social with pictures of your wine and delicious dinners. Again, that bottle of wine for a penny is at dryfarmwines.com/healnourishgrow.
Well, and I think because when you find the people, like you're saying, going to support groups, those are people that are obviously now quite invested in their health and healing. And so I'd imagine that they're just excited that somebody is willing to listen to their story and to try to help others down the road.
We're so generous. They truly were. In fact, right now for book two, I've been interviewing women that have had heart attacks, and the generosity from women to women is just, I love doing it. I just love it. It's fantastic.
Yeah. And I think you seem, I just, a little bit I've known of you today and just chatting beforehand, you just have a way of, you know, putting people at ease, which is really great. And I think that will lend itself very well to your research.
It does. It actually does. I really learned, and I actually learned it the hard way. The secret to good interviewing is for the kind of interviewing I'm doing is never to interview people you know, because it stopped me. I did it with, I thought, well, you know, I've had a couple friends that have had whatever it was, and it doesn't work, because I found myself hesitating to ask stuff because they're friends. It's none of my business. But interviewing gives you the right and the legal and moral obligation to ask anything you want to. You know, it's like, boy, become an interviewer. It's wonderful.
Well, not only that, I find one of the most gratifying things about this work of, you know, I'm doing a totally different kind of interview when I talk to people for the podcast, but it's kind of like people approach me and they'll say, well, what about this? And it's like, oh, I've been researching that before and I want to know more about it. So very selfish is me sometimes. I agree to the interview, you know?
Sure. That's exactly what I would do. It's great fun.
So what did you find when you were talking to, you said you kind of did it by disease, but across all of these diseases, was there any kind of consistent thread that you found between groups? So it didn't matter what their disease was, but there was kind of maybe an overarching theme, or was it all different depending on what it was?
No, there were some definite overarching themes. In fact, that's what I was looking for, were the overarching themes. I wasn't interested in particularly in the disease. I was interested in the behavior and the decision-making that accompanied the disease. And I figured, my hypothesis was that as women, we probably make our decisions in fairly similar ways. And we do. I mean, I was right. The first thing, for example, that I discovered was that we all, as women, we put ourselves last. There was a research study done where researchers gave women a list of 5 things to prioritize. Who would they care? What would they take care of first? And I think it was like 80% of the, or 100% even, of the women said first they would take care of their children. And then second, they would take care of their pets, which I loved. And then And third, they would take care of their elderly parents. And as an elderly parent, you know, I did not like reading that, but there it was. And fourth, they take care of their partners. And last but not least, fifth, they would take care of themselves. And I found that so many of the women that I talked with had put off going to the doctor. They had their a project due at work. Their kid had a play at school they had to go to. There was lunches to make, whatever. So by the time they got to the doctor, some of them, a minor issue had become a major one. And I think that that's a real downfall. And then, as I said earlier, a lot of them hesitated to get second opinions. And, you know, if you have an autoimmune disease like fibromyalgia or lupus or endometriosis, I mean, it can take up to 7 to 10 years to get a diagnosis. So you certainly can't just go to one doctor, have him or her tell you that it's all in your head, and then go home and feel bad. And that happened to a lot of women. Fortunately, some of them also went to as many as 5 or 6 doctors. And those doctors really, you know, there's not, I guess what I'm saying is there's not always a definitive test, and a diagnosis is not always a definitive thing. It's not that easy, as I said earlier. So second opinions are critical.
This is a little bit off topic, but I think not as much as maybe on the surface it seems, is that there's this trend now towards more concierge doctors, which of course not everybody can afford that, and also a trend towards more functional medicine type of practices. Yes. So I'm curious if any of the women that you talk to, so there, it's very common that what you said, because medicine is so siloed, like you said, gastroenterologist for your stomach, cardiologist for your heart.
Right.
But did anybody find a doctor that was more holistic and that was more of a functional approach? Did that seem to help their outcomes or the way that they were able to make decisions at all? Or have you not run across that yet?
I did not run across that. And I think partly it was timing. And it took me about 10 years to write this book. I mean, part time, obviously.
Oh, wow.
But so the women I interviewed at this point, because the book came out in 2022. So that was, let's say, 10 years ago. And concierge medicine, as I recall, did not exist at that time. Functional medicine probably did, but it was not nearly as popular as it is now. And concierge medicine is expensive. It really is.
Very.
And functional medicine, I've been on several podcasts where the doctors were functional medicine doctors. And that's, I've never been to one, but it certainly sounds like a good thing to me.
Yeah, it seems like it would help that process in some way. That's why I was curious. And I, like I said, I don't know if it's relevant or not, but it might be something to keep an eye out for, because they're kind of more focused on the whole system. So maybe even though you were having a problem with, say, your stomach or whatever it was, and say maybe it was more female related than gastroenterology, maybe they could work that out sooner somehow. I don't know. But that's my own theory.
Well, and I'll tell you how it is related, because I think it's really important. One of the things I talk about in the second opinion chapter is if you do get one, and of course, I hope you will, you want to go to a doctor who's totally different from your primary doctor. Mm. What I recommend in the book is if your doctor was trained at the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota, go to somebody who was trained at Stanford in California. I mean, you want a very different opinion. You want to know what all the other possibilities could be, and we see what we expect to see. So if you go to a doctor in the same office, or even a doctor that your doctor recommends, it may be because they met in medical school and had similar training, and that's not what you want. You want different training.
Yeah, no, that's an amazing and very good, like, actionable takeaway for people listening to this podcast, is it definitely, number one, get the second opinion, and number two, having it be somebody totally different is, I think, amazing advice. What were the other things that the women had in common?
Well, one of the things I noticed is that they all, how do I say this? Women talk to doctors differently from how men do. And a lot of the women I talked to, really, when they told the doctor their various symptoms, they went into all the feelings and all the emotions that they had and talked about how tired they were and how irritated they were, et cetera, et cetera. And when a man goes in, they're much more succinct, much more objective. They don't want to whine or be accused of whining or thought to be whining. They don't want to act like a baby. Whereas women, and I am totally guilty of this, I pour out the whole story. I not only say that my throat hurts or I broke my leg, but it's affecting my whole life in and here's how. And I think that that can distort the doctor's diagnosis. For one thing, and this has happened to me, my physical symptoms have become secondary to my emotional ones, but I went there for my physical symptoms. So I didn't mean to, but I distorted and lost the focus of the visit. So that's happened. And men have better luck with that because they are more succinct.
Like what you hear so far? Make sure you never miss a show by clicking the subscribe button now. We'd also love it if you could post a review on iTunes. It helps us so much by allowing others to more easily find us. The Heal, Nourish, Grow podcast wouldn't be possible without listeners like you. Thank you so much for your support. Now back to the show.
And then the other thing that happens is the doctor then says, well, you're upset, so I think you're probably depressed. Let's try an antidepressant. Well, if I broke my hip, an antidepressant is not going to do me much good. And so not only did I distort the diagnosis, but the prescription is inaccurate. And then I go home and I feel bad. I mean, and that's how it goes. And I think a lot of that comes from, or not a lot of it, but much of it does come from how we describe our symptoms. I think it's very important to stay on topic. I do think we need to talk about our feelings. I don't mean that we don't. But at the same time, we need to be careful that we don't lose sight of the physical symptoms that we're there for in the first place.
Yeah, that's another great piece of advice. Would you recommend, I mean, like you said, so women need to talk about their feelings. Maybe they need to talk about how they're feeling with whatever the health problem is with their friends or a therapist. But when they go to the doctor, could you see like maybe making a list of the symptoms, or what do you feel might help them get the most out of a visit that would be more directed?
You don't know this, but you just inadvertently asked my very favorite question. I'm so and I will tell you why. We have very specific tips that I strongly believe in when you go for your doctor visit. And I'm going to list them if that's okay, because
absolutely,
it's one of the most important parts of the book. The first thing you want to do is go in with a written list of your symptoms. And I say written because if you don't have it in your head, because if you're at all like me and I get anxious and everything I wanted to say it goes right out. So I have a written list. And I've prioritized my symptoms so that I make sure that what I think is most important goes first. And the other thing I like about a written list, and a doctor actually told me this, I hadn't thought of it, but she said, the doctor I talked with said that she loves it when patients come in with a list, because if she looks at it and she sees it's prioritized, but if she thinks the priority should be the other way around, she has the opportunity to rearrange the list and what she thinks is the most significant. And that's really important. So that's the first thing. You go in with a written list. And the second thing that I think is really important is to ask the doctor, once you get your diagnosis, for the clinical name of your disease and to have them spell it for you. Because if you're like me, I can't spell it. I won't even discuss my spelling.
But now that if they have an English degree.
I have a master's in English, but now that I have spelled it, I don't even, you know, I think I have
a brain anymore.
Exactly. But seriously, you absolutely want to know how to spell it, because I'm going to, at the back of my book, and I'm going to sidebar for a minute. The back of the book has a terrific resource section. It tells you, the back of the book inside. Yeah.
Oh, right? I see. Yes. Oh, yeah. Here we go. Directory. It's a whole, yes, a whole list of all these things at the back.
How to do your research, how to find a doctor, how to find a good hospital, etc. So please check it out. But you want to be able to go home, and if you have access to a computer, and look up your disease. Does it feel right to you? Are the symptoms that Google or whoever you use lists, is that what you have? How does this feel to you? And then the other thing, when you get a diagnosis, you want to say to your doctor, what else could this possibly be? And if they blow you off, if they say, oh, nothing, I'm sure I'm right. One of the things that actually, again, a doctor taught me to say is, I know you've had a lot of experience with patients who have symptoms like mine. Have they all had disease X, or did some of them perhaps have something else? And again, you want the name and the spelling of that diagnosis as well. And then go home and do your research and look in my book, and it'll tell you. I think I go to the Mayo Clinic a lot. I go to Cleveland Clinic because they're good for heart. It tells you in there. So let's see. So what have I told you? I've told you to get a written list, do your research, of course, get second opinions. We've already done that. And the thing that I also think is very important is to reframe in your own words what you've heard the doctor say. And that does two things. It gives you the chance to make sure that you heard correctly. And it gives the doctor a chance to be sure that they spoke or said what they meant to say. I mean, we all misspeak. We're all people. So you want to make sure that when you leave the office, you fully understand what you've been told. And I think if you do those things and the last thing is take somebody with you if you can. Because again, like me, I don't hear very well. I mean, physically I hear fine, but emotionally, if they're saying something I don't like, I just shut down. So if you do those four or five things, you really focus the visit. Hopefully you'll get exactly what you need. And I think that's so many women leave the doctor's office. More people leave the doctor's office. I mean, this is a research statistic. More people leave the doctor's office not fully understanding what's been said. And you can't do that. I mean, it's your body. You don't want to take a treatment for a disease that you're not sure you have, don't understand, etc.
So yeah, not only that, but even if you heard it correctly, sometimes you'll go and I think one of the things that you said there that's amazing. I mean, you know, people have this hate on Dr. Google, but Dr. Google is amazing. You need Dr. Google, right?
Yeah, it is amazing, truly. And also there are even more sophisticated sites. Some of the stuff on Google, for example, is inaccurate. I mean, you have to be careful. Yeah. But if you go,
especially now.
Well, yeah. And if you go to the Mayo Clinic or something of that caliber, your chances of getting misinformation are probably less than 1%. And I made that up. I don't know, but I'm assuming that.
Right. Well, I would say one thing, people know my love of PubMed and reading research studies. And we were talking a little bit before, having gone to graduate school, I'm not like the best person in the world at it, but I'm certainly probably better than average at reading a study, being able to understand it, knowing if it's a good study. Right. The one thing I would caution people with reading studies and looking at studies is don't just look at the title and look at the conclusion, because quite often sometimes what they say in the conclusion, the data doesn't actually support that, which is quite interesting.
That's interesting.
Well, scientists try to keep bias out, and some are better than others. And then also if you go to the end of the research article, it'll say if they have any conflict of interest and sometimes about their funding, which they say Cheerios is healthier than an apple,
right?
You might want to check the conclusions and see who's funding them.
And so many studies are funded by drug companies, so be really careful. Absolutely. That's important. And I think, incidentally, talking about drug companies, I think that it's really important to research the drug you're given or the prescription.
Oh, yes.
Don't just take it. And let me tell you a quick story. I mean, in a way, it's a silly story, but it makes my point. I've never had any pain. Don't ask me why. I'm just lucky. And so, but I'm 81. Shit happens, if you'll pardon the expression. I wake up one morning and I have a sore thumb. And I thought, oh, well, okay. So I let it go. But then it stayed sore. So because I've done all this research, I'm now highly neurotic. I've turned into a hypochondriac. So I decided maybe it was bone cancer. So whatever, my kids said, well, Mom, why don't you start with an arthritis doctor? So I go to the arthritis doctor and she said, yes, you know, you have arthritis in your thumb. Here's some medication for the pain. I mean, it wasn't that bad, but okay. And I said, well, you know, I'm on Lexapro for depression. I just lost my husband and I need to take the Lexapro. Does it interfere at all with my depression medication? And she said, no, not at all. So, okay, great. I take the prescription. I go home. But because I'm now so neurotic, I look it up. And, you know, she was mostly right. There was a 1% chance that it would interfere with my depression medication. But on the other hand, the 1% chance was a chance of a brain bleed. So, you know, it's only 1%, but I was not willing to risk a possible brain bleed. Somebody's going to be the 1%, right? So yeah. We're talking about a thumb. I got 9 other fingers, if worse comes to worse. I mean, it just wasn't worth it to me. So my point is, by doing the research, I was able to evaluate the risks and benefits for myself and make a decision. And I threw out the prescription, obviously. But I mean, you can't always do that. If it's chemotherapy, it doesn't matter what it is. If you have to have it, you have to have it. But for something like a thumb or whatever, I just got off a statin because it was interfering with my blood pressure medication. I couldn't figure out what was, I just wasn't feeling right. And and again, I looked it up, which the doctor didn't know. And so he just said, well, throw it out. So I did. But that's why it's, you know, I think the message of the whole book really is it's your body and you got to take charge of it. And yes, the doctor will tell you what to do. And most of the time they're right. I'm a firm believer in medicine. I truly am. But that doesn't mean that I give up all my power and all my research ability to double check, to be sure. And most people would have said, well, you know, my thumb really hurts. Maybe I play tennis and I really need to have my thumb fixed because my forehand is really suffering. I mean, I don't know. But that wasn't me. So it's a personal decision as well. And I think that being in charge of yourself is just critical.
Yeah, and that's another excellent point, because quite often I think people, you know, it would be great if we could just take a pill and there was no side effects and the pill fixed things. But the problem is there are side effects and there are interactions, and you've got to, whatever the problem is it bad enough that you need to go down that road yet? Like, I have osteoarthritis in both knees, and pretty bad actually. But to this point, I'm functional on a day-to-day basis without, it's an amount of pain I can live with and it's fine. Right. And so I would much rather just live like that for now than, you know, do a risky surgery or take drugs that could possibly have these other side effects. And I think you're exactly right. It stinks because we think we want to go to the doctor just so tell us what to do and let's be done with it and I'll be fixed. But you can't, unfortunately, you just can't do that with your own health. You've got to dig in a little bit and make some hard decisions.
I had the same experience with, I went to the doctor. I have now, so I'm just getting old sutz, I have to tell you. So now I'm older. So I went to the doctor and he said, well, you have rotator cuff issues. And again, it's minor. I mean, I haven't taken anything. I just wanted, again, I wanted to make sure what it was, and they did an x-ray and okay. And he said, well, don't you want surgery? And I said, well, you know, I think I'll just start with the Tylenol. I mean, you know, I don't need, I mean, wow. You know, that was, we went from A to Z. So I think, again, it's just really, and I said, no, thank you. And, you know, he said, well, we're surgeons. And I didn't say, but I wanted to so bad. You know, well, your mother must be really proud of you. But, you know, I mean, you know, it was silly. But anyway, so went home, shoulder still hurts, but oh, well, you know.
Yeah, well, and like you said, and just making sure that it's not something more significant. Like, I'll tell this story that's relevant to what, because how, you know, we trust doctors, but yet you need to be careful. So my dad had cancer for many years and it was in remission. He was doing really well. And he's always been super active, weightlifter, golf, all the things. And he had been having a lot of hip pain while playing golf. And they, you know, he went to probably the orthopedic guy was the first thing he thought of. And so, like you said, it's a hammer, it's a nail, it's an orthopedic guy. Well, you've got a hip thing. We're going to send you to PT or whatever. Anyway, the long story short is that it ended up being a recurrence of his bone cancer, and he had bone cancer and he's having a problem with his bone. And that's not the first thing that they thought of. So it's just really, yeah, you've got to be really careful and you've got to be an advocate for your own health. And the fact that it didn't dawn on anybody, probably including myself at the time, that this was a potential recurrence, it's kind of mind-blowing to me, you know?
The upside and the downside of doing all this research is now everything occurs to me. I've been interviewing with heart attacks and I'm walking around every time now I get a stomach pain. I think, oh my God. It's good and it's bad, let me tell you.
So Susan, you've talked a lot, and I didn't get to read the book yet, so you probably answer this in the book, or if you haven't, maybe it's a question for future. But so the women in particular are very bad about this because they're always putting themselves last. But for the people that they do put first, their loved ones, their parents, their partner, their children, was there also advice in the book for how to advocate for those people in their lives? Or was it more just focused on kind of this putting themselves in the back seat scenario?
It was neither. I mean, it was focused on how do I say it? On a woman as a patient.
For so many years, I've focused on what I've been putting into my body, but it's only in the last few years that I've gotten more focused on environmental toxins. Did you know that while only about 10 ingredients are banned for personal care in the US, that the European Union has banned more than 1,600 chemicals in these products? Besides that, there are forever chemicals in our drinking water, storage items like plastic containers, and even the cookware. Many chemicals found in U.S. beauty products are toxic, hormone-disrupting chemicals that negatively affect fertility and can cause cancer, among other things that contribute to poor health. Avoiding these environmental toxins can all get a little bit overwhelming for sure. I know one reason you listen to the podcast and visit Heal, Nourish, Grow is because you know I do the research. I'm trying to get better about writing articles on these things when I go down a particular rabbit hole to study any health kind of situation for myself, but all that takes time. For the last several years, I'd go to the Environmental Working Group website to discover what products are considered safer than others, but it's an imperfect system and it's time consuming. So I finally decided to fully make the switch to Beauty Counter personal care products. Not only are they committed to making high quality, well-performing products, they are also a force for change in the beauty industry. They've lobbied the government to enforce stricter regulations. Until the day comes where manufacturers are forced to get rid of these chemicals in their products, Beauty Counter makes it really easy to clean up your routine. Best of all, you can return any product for any reason within 60 days, so cleaning up your beauty care and skin routine really is risk-free. If you're interested in learning more, simply go to cleanbeauty.healnourishgrow.com to download your clean beauty guide. Or if you're ready to shop risk-free right now and get 20% off of your first order, go to healnourishgrow.com/beautycounter and find the products you like. If you need any help, get in touch with me first. And then when you go to check out, enter clean for all 20 and you'll get 20% off your first order.
But I do recommend that as women, as I said earlier, we take somebody with us. And of course, we also should go when one of our loved ones goes to the doctor, we should go with them as well. And I think it's okay to, I mean, I think you need to advocate for somebody. Let me think about how I want to say this. Well, I mean, for example, I was reading an article, this has nothing to do with me or my family, but there was a woman that whose dementia was getting worse. I forget where I read this. And she was with her daughter, and her daughter, the doctor said, well, you know, it's just like it was, or whatever he said. And the daughter said, no, she's much worse. You don't see it right now, but at home she did this and she did that, you know. So I think it is really, as the guest of your, as the accompanying person, you can set the doctor straight if they need it. Because you know, and the woman didn't know, but the daughter did, is my point.
That's an excellent point. I mean, just have an example of that too, that I could share is that I haven't actually talked about this on the podcast yet, but my husband had triple bypass surgery in November. And we had gone into the emergency room because he did have pain a couple of days in a row, but he was telling the doctor about some things. And I said, well, did you tell him about how you've been having that heartburn that you keep talking about for, you know, we're in the ER. Well, it turns out what he had been calling or thinking of as heartburn was a symptom of his heart not getting enough oxygen, obviously. So me having been there really redirected the conversation and the outcome pretty quickly, because they were like, well, pain under your rib, that's really not like a heart attack. You know what I mean? They were just kind of confused by the whole thing. And then here it turned out he had a very serious problem that I don't know how long it would have taken him to dig into all that, you know?
Right. And if he had been a woman, women really have to wait much longer to get a heart attack diagnosis. I mean, I'm an expert on heart attacks right now for the next book. But that, let me just say to all of the women out there, if you do think you're having a heart attack, or even if you're unsure and you go to emergency and they say, no, it's a stomach ache, or no, you're depressed or whatever, ask for an echocardiogram. That should give you or a blood test, so that they will be, that way it will really determine whether your heart's under stress, because women do get misdiagnosed a lot when it comes to emergency room heart attacks. That's another.
Yeah, and yet it's still the number one killer for us as well as men. Isn't that correct?
Absolutely. By far, as a matter of fact. I think.
Well, Susan, you mentioned the new book. I would just want to be respectful of your time before we start to wrap things up. Do you want to, or can you share a little bit about, I mean, you said it's about women and heart attacks, anything that you're seeing like initially, or do you need more people to talk to? If anybody hears this and they have, you know, a certain experience, should they get in touch?
I'm okay. It's actually, the book is on gaslighting, and I want to talk a lot about it because women are gaslit more than men are. And it's a very popular topic right now. And so the way I'm handling it is I talk about gaslighting a lot, and I talk about it in terms of heart attacks, which is what I've been interviewing, and in terms of chronic pain, and going to be in terms of autoimmune diseases, because pain and autoimmune in particular are where women get gaslit very, very frequently. So anybody out there in chronic pain or anybody out there with autoimmune diseases where they've been gaslit, I would love to hear. And of course, I also want to hear some good stories. The last chapter of the book is going to talk about what a good story looks like, you know, how the doctor visit should go. And I've already heard a couple of those with heart attack, the heart attack women I've interviewed. So,
well, that's good to hear. So they're not all negative. That's very good.
Not at all. Not at all.
Well, if people, I do have one final thing, and this is completely, I almost forgot, because I also loved this when I read your bio, that you said that you power lift in your spare time. So how did that get started?
Actually, it got started in my 40s because I was told I had osteoporosis, which is what problem had been in the first place, if you remember. But in any event, they told me it was so bad, and I don't know if I've never broken anything yet, but they said I could be one of those women that stepped off a curb and, you know, everything shattered. So I got terrified.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. And then she said, they told me that the doctor was a woman, and she said, you know, you really need to do some walking and some resistance and. So I started weightlifting, and I mean, I got to say two things. I hate it and I love it all at the same time. Any sense. I get so damn bored, I can't tell you. But yet here I am, I'm 81, I'm in really good shape. I'm strong and I haven't broken any bones, and know whether that's probably mostly good luck, but nevertheless I haven't. And if you saw me walk, you'd think I was, you know, I'm not bent over and I don't walk slowly. I walk like a person, you know, a normal 50-year-old woman. And I do think that without question, it's due to the weightlifting. I really do. It's kept me strong and straight. And I feel good about myself, which at 81 can be tricky. I mean, honest, it can.
I'm sure. And I think it's just amazing that your doctor at the time, 40 years ago, because this is just now becoming a really big conversation in the health and wellness. You might have heard of, you know, Dr. Gabrielle Lyon is really big on the women's muscle health movement. And, you know, others out there getting proper protein and prioritizing protein and to prevent sarcopenia, because sarcopenia and frailty in old age is like one of the biggest predictors of poor health outcomes. So I'm just so glad that you had a doctor that shared that with you and that you
did. I mean, I see it in a few of my friends, not that many, because most of them are pretty good about working out. But frailty is really a very significant problem. And also being too thin is a significant problem when you're older, because if you do get sick, you need to have a few pounds cushion, so that if you weigh 90 pounds and you lose 5 pounds, now you're 85. That's not good. You're better off to start at 120 or 50 or whatever it is, so that you have some pounds to lose. I learned that too.
Is another great piece of advice. I always kind of joked around with that with my a previous person in my life, and she was probably 85 and she was still trying to go on diets. I was like, Jane, come on, you need to, because she was not obese or anything. She wasn't like rail thin anymore, but she was a strong, like, you know,
no, you
properly
don't...
properly weighted person for her age and her stature, you know.
Thin and frail is not a goal. Not at all. Not at all.
And I loved, you got to go check out Susan's TikTok. I don't know if you do this I think Instagram was a little bit different, but on Susan's TikTok, before we got on the podcast, I was checking it out and I saw that, and I'm trying this next time that I go to the gym, but she was on a BOSU ball and did like five legit awesome push-ups. So I am totally trying that next time at the gym.
It's called, I think, it's probably under my name, but it's Grandma.Gains.
Yeah, I loved that name. And yeah, we'll put all these links in the show notes. But if people do want to get in touch, what's the best way?
I'm so old, I didn't know what Grandma Gaines meant. My grandchildren, Grandma, that's a perfect name. Everybody will know. And of course, I didn't know, but my trainer knew instantly. So what do I know? It's fun. Oh. And I like to show
I love
up.
It.
It's good.
You should. It's inspiring. So what's the very best way if people, I mean, people can follow you everywhere, but what are you, what's your most active channel or how can people get in touch if they want to reach out about the books or your research?
Well, the social media, I'm very active on Instagram. And Salinger is S-A-L-E-N-G-E-R. So I spell it differently.
Good note.
So it's Instagram and TikTok. I think if you dial up Susan Salinger, it'll take you right to Grandma Gaines or go to Grandma Gaines and there I'll be. At least I hope so. That's the plan. And you can buy the book on Amazon or bookshop.org. I mean, it's in any bookstore. They can order it wherever. Okay. And as you said, it'll be in the show. But thank you.
And do we have a release date on the new one before you go?
Well, one can only hope. I'm giving myself 6 months to a year to do it. That sounds like a long time, but frankly, the last one took me 10, and this is going much faster. But it's hard to find the people. That's why I said, if anybody's out there, maybe put my email. I don't know if you have, you must have it in the show notes.
Yeah. Too,
'cause if you email me, I'll get back to you, I promise.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, so anybody with stories about gaslighting, any kind of health-related
right.
negative chronic, or positive scenario.
Immune, whatever you can, whatever. Medications, you know, I want examples. I need examples because I really want it to be women's personal stories and how we can do it, how we can handle it when it occurs. And it can be tricky. I mean, it can be really tricky to handle.
Yes. Well, Susan, I thoroughly enjoyed this today, and I wish you the very best on the next book. And these endeavors that you're taking on right now are just so amazing, and I'm happy to hear all of this.
Thank you so much. Old age can be a really nice time in life, I have to say. It really can. Sometimes it sucks, as I said. But basically, my kids are out of the house. My grandchildren are grown. I mean, the narcissism, just taking care of myself is lovely.
Well, I love it. And you've certainly earned it. So, Susan, thanks for doing the show. And we'll stay in touch in the future.
Sounds good. Thanks so much for having me.
This has been the Heal, Nourish, Grow podcast. Again, I'm Cheryl McColgan, founder of Heal, Nourish, Grow. You can find show notes for this episode at healnourishgrowpodcast.com. If you have feedback on today's episode or questions about the content, please email us at podcast@healnourishgrow.com. We'd love to hear from you. Be sure to sign up for our email list at healnourishgrow.com and subscribe to the show with your favorite podcast player so you never miss an episode. Join us next time for more information that helps you live your best and healthiest life. Thanks for listening. Content on the Heal, Nourish, Grow podcast does not constitute medical advice. Content contained in the Heal, Nourish, Grow podcast is not intended as medical diagnosis or treatment. Neither the company nor its owner, Heal, Nourish, Grow, LLC, nor any of the company's employees, agents, or guest speakers provide medical advice. The content provided on Heal, Nourish, Grow podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only. Please consult your medical provider with any questions about what health practices are right for you.